kind of short. I have to stand on my tiptoes here. I'm reading from Genesis 37. Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made a richly ornamented robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brothers said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream. And this time, the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." When he told his father, as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Now, his brothers had gone to graze their father's flock near Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, "As you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I'm going to send you to them." "Very well," he replied. So he said to him, "Go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me." Then he sent him off from the valley of Hebron. When Joseph arrived at Shechem, a man found him wandering around in the fields and asked him, "What are you looking for?" He replied, "I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they are grazing their flocks?" "They've moved on from here," the man answered. "I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. But when they saw him in the distance and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. "Here comes that dreamer," they said to each other. "Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams." When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. "Let's not take his life," he said. "Don't shed any blood. Throw him into the cistern here in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him." Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the richly ornamented robe that he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. Now the cistern was empty, and there was no water in it. They sat down to eat their meal. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood." His brothers agreed. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy isn't there. Where can I turn now?" Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. They took the ornamented robe back to their father, and they said, "We found this. Examine it to see whether it's your son's robe." He recognized it and said, "This is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on a sackcloth, and mourned for his son for many days. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "in mourning I will go down to the grave to my son." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard.
Heard a flower. Come on, you beautiful miracle! You know what happened? Global warming. It's an inconvenient truth. I know.
Should have seen that one coming. You pick a flower and you carve the Grand Canyon. Sometimes it's a little bit difficult to see where the consequences of our actions are going to go. We're human beings. We're not omniscient. Pitifully not omniscient, and sometimes we get ourselves into great messes as a result. Because we know where this story of Joseph is going, we can look, we can see this dream is from God, we can see what he's doing, we can see already that God is working through events to accomplish his purposes. And that's going to be the recurring theme of the story that we're going to keep coming back to in the life of Joseph. But when we just look at chapter 37, what we see is a whole lot of really bad choices that turn out really badly. Human beings are not masters of their own fate. We are tragically incapable of foreseeing the future. And in this chapter, people are kind of shooting themselves in the foot left and right. The very goal that they're pursuing, they end up driving further away by the sinful means they use to pursue that goal. And so they're worse off than when they started. Couple examples. We'll call this one Jacob's self-defeating favoritism. When we look at the events of this story, maybe Jacob's not the first sinner that we think of. We kind of look at Joseph's brothers and say, well, that's the real problem right there. And yet, also looking back over Jacob's life, we know this is a dysfunctional family. He always intended to marry Rachel. He got tricked by his uncle into marrying her sister Leah. And then he decided he'd marry Rachel also, and Rachel's servant, and Leah's servant, and have children by all four marriages. What could possibly go wrong? It says he loved Rachel, but also that he hated Leah. Now, that may not mean like outright hostility towards Leah. It may be kind of a Hebrew dichotomy between love and hate that means I chose this person over this person. Whatever the case may be, though, this favoritism that he had between his four wives transferred over to favoritism between his 12 children, his 12 sons anyway. His favorite son is the oldest of his favorite wife's sons. And you might think, is it wrong? Is Jacob at fault here for having a special affection for the son of his beloved wife who is now dead? Maybe not. Although we often excuse ourselves for our feelings. We say, hey, that's just how I feel. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. I just feel that way, and I can't help how I feel. That's not strictly true. Our feelings are not on a light switch, perhaps. We can't just turn them on and off at will. And yet we can influence the way that we feel about things slowly over time by the things we choose to let our thoughts dwell on. I might love all kinds of sinful things if I let my heart dwell on them. That doesn't mean they're good. That doesn't mean that they're healthy, that those feelings are reasonable or acceptable. To a certain extent, I am responsible for the state of my heart through the things I choose to feed my heart. And Jacob has been nurturing for 17 years, more than that, through the life of his Joseph's mother before Joseph was ever born. He's been nurturing this special affection for his 11th son over all the others. And this comes out in his actions, not surprisingly. He actively pursues the well-being and honor of Joseph at the expense of his other sons. Most famously, he gives Joseph this special coat. And we're not really clear what's special about this coat. There's this tradition about it being a many-colored coat. That's kind of from the Greek and Latin translations of the Old Testament. The Hebrew word's kind of obscure. It may mean that it reaches down to his palms and to his feet. It's a long robe. David's daughter, King David's daughter Tamar, actually has a similar robe that's used the same description. And it's said to distinguish her as a daughter of the king. It's this appointment of royalty. And so whatever it looked like, we know what the point of the robe was. We know what it meant. That Joseph was special. That he was honored above all his brothers. He may also have had a position of authority over his brothers. When verse 2 says that Joseph was shepherding with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, these are the wives that were the servants of the other wives. And so it may be that Joseph, well, he's said to bring a bad report about them. Now, is he just being a tattletale? Or has he been in a position of authority over his older brothers who are the sons of the servant wives? All the more reason for them to hate him. Whatever the case, it says, Jacob loved Joseph more than all his other children. That's not like, well, it just kind of feels that way. No, he really did. Verse 3 is completely blunt about it. He valued Joseph more than all of his other children. And he went out of his way to lift up Joseph over his brothers so that the son of his favorite wife would receive the greater honor. Tragically, the exact opposite happens. Now, to be fair, should Jacob have anticipated that his other sons would kill Joseph or sell him? Hopefully not. No parent really expects that their children are going to kill one of them. But that's kind of the point. The consequences of his actions were beyond what he could see. He didn't know what would happen. He made the wrong choice by exalting one child, especially the 11th child out of 12, 11th son, over all the others and treating the others less important than their younger brother. He did it on purpose. It wasn't accidental. He was going out of his way to do it. And the consequences were the exact opposite of what he was trying to achieve. He built up so much animosity between Joseph and his brothers that rather than exalting him, he ended up making him an enemy of his brothers and then a slave. So was that Jacob's fault? Did Jacob cause the brothers to sell him? No. But the point is, he was out of control. There were 10 other factors that he was not considering, that he could not control. He couldn't decide what would happen. Jacob could not foresee the consequences. Jacob was not in control, and his sin drove what he wanted further away. But then so did the brothers, right? Joseph's brothers, we'll call this their self-defeating jealousy. You know, we kind of understood where Jacob was coming from. He didn't ask to marry Leah. Okay, he wanted to marry Rachel. He was kind of tricked into this. Like, oh, poor guy. We can see why Jacob had a favorite son, and that was the son of the wife that he always actually wanted to marry. On the other hand, we can also see where Joseph's brothers are coming from. By the way, they would have hated that I'm referring to them as Joseph's brothers. Like the sidekicks, the supporting cast in Joseph's show. Because that's the way they've been treated their whole lives, at least since Joseph's been born. So verse 4 says, "When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to them." They hated that robe. They hated the fact that Joseph walked around wearing this outfit that said, "My dad thinks I'm better than you." So when later on Joseph wanders haplessly into their midst and they jump him, what's the first thing they do to him? They strip off that robe. They hated that robe. They hated being reminded that they were second place. And so they figured they'd fix that. Pretty simple idea. Get rid of Joseph. He's not the best anymore. Their father's affections would have to find a new object, and they'd get more of his attention or more of his affection, perhaps. Now, did they really want to kill him? Not particularly. Reuben, of course, was flat out against it. Mind you, he wasn't so against it that he actually took Joseph's side or put himself on the line against his brothers. He just said, "Oh, let's just throw him in a pit, and I'll rescue him in secret later." He wasn't willing to stand up for him. What's Reuben's main concern? Verse 30. I'll back up to verse 29. "When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes, so upset. 'Oh no, Joseph, oh, what will we do about Joseph?' He went back to his brothers and said, 'The boy isn't there. Where can I turn now?'" We're not upset about Joseph nearly so much as we're upset about Reuben. Joseph going missing is bad for Reuben. He's the oldest. What's he going to do when he heads home and there's no Joseph? Reuben wants to know what's best for Reuben. Likewise, when they see that they can both get rid of Joseph and turn a prophet at the same time, Judah says, "Hey, guys, let's not kill our brother. He is our brother after all." "Oh, yeah, that's right. He is our brother. You don't kill your brother. You sell your brother." Right. Okay. So everybody's on board with this plan. Sell their brother. They're not homicidal maniacs. They don't delight in killing people. They're just acting in what they believe to be their own self-interest. They're not going to play second fiddle to Joseph anymore. Their father would be forced to change his focus and affection from him to them. And yet again, the consequences of their sinful actions drive away the very goal that they were striving to achieve. And what they did was horrible. I mean, how can you trick a father into believing that their child is dead? Maybe they got some grim satisfaction out of dipping that hateful robe in goat's blood so that they could announce that Joseph was no longer to be a part of their family. But when their deception works, when their father believes exactly what they want him to believe, do they now get his affection? The plan worked, but then it didn't. Instead of giving them more affection, he completely withdraws from them. He pulls back. He shuts himself down to the rest of the world, and they end up receiving even less affection than they did before. Now, should they have anticipated this? Should they have known that Jacob was just going to shut them all out and say, "I don't even have any children anymore. I don't even have a life anymore. I'm just going to mourn for this one child that died." Should they have seen that coming? Maybe not. But that's the point. Joseph's brothers could not foresee the consequences. Joseph's brothers were not in control, and their sin drove what they wanted further away. So how can we think that our sinful choices will turn out any better? And we start out just like they did, just like Jacob and his sons. There's something that we want. It sounds reasonable enough. So we have our excuse for acting selfishly, and we do. But we have no idea what we might be getting ourselves into. When we sin, we have to believe at least two lies, which are basically two sides of the same coin. One, that God cannot be trusted with my well-being. And two, that this sin will make my life better. What's the sin that you struggle with? Maybe it's losing your temper. Like I fly off the handle. I vent my anger at somebody because there's a situation that I don't know how to fix. I feel out of control, and venting my anger makes me feel like I have a little more control. Or gossip, passing on information about another person. And it may be true. Gossip doesn't have to be false. But it doesn't present the other person in the best light. And it makes me interesting to listen to. If you've never caught yourself gossiping, you probably do it all the time. You just don't think there's anything wrong with it. Or what Paul calls selfish ambition, insisting and fighting for my own way. I'm going to get what I want, no matter what somebody else has to give up. Or greed and coveting, being discontent with my home, or my possessions, or my spouse, or my situation in life. Always wanting something more, something better. We don't choose these things when we trust God for our well-being. How do I figure? If God has supplied everything that we need, we don't need to seek our good through selfish means, through sinful means. If I obey Him, or if I trust Him, then I obey Him. I talked to a woman once that wanted to divorce her wife, her husband. Why? Because she wanted to feel more free. That's it. No other complaint. Just wanted to feel more free. I showed her what God said about divorce. And she responded, "I think God wants me to be happy." I don't think that's really true. I don't think she really believed that. Because she completely disregarded what He had to say to her life. If we disobey God, whatever we may say we believe, it proves that we either believe that God does not want us to be happy and He commands us these things whether we're going to be happy with them or not, or that God does want us to be happy, He just has no idea how to accomplish that. And so He says, "Okay, sure, you know, I thought this was a good idea, I thought this would make your life better, but I guess I was wrong, you know better than I, go ahead, do whatever you want." If we disobey, we're assuming it's going to make our lives better. And I might even admit, you know, this is probably a bad idea in the long run. I'm probably going to regret this. But right now, in this moment, I believe that that instant gratification of the disobedience, of that selfish choice, is going to be worth whatever consequences I have to deal with later. But then, surprise, surprise, venting my anger does not make me feel better. It doesn't make me feel in control. It just makes the other person act in ways that make me even more angry. Feeding my greed doesn't satisfy it. It just makes it grow bigger. I'm rewarding myself for acting greedily. And so forth. When you think of whatever sin that you tend toward, you may feel like you've got the consequences managed, got it under control. But here's the thing, we're not in control of the consequences. We can't see what's ahead. We're around other human beings that we don't make their choices for them. They make their own choices that I can't imagine. We shouldn't expect that they're going to act better than we did, or in a way that we expect. If I vent my anger at somebody, they may be harboring some hurt that I just stick a knife into. And I have no idea how they may respond out of that hurt. And we find we couldn't foresee the consequences. We were not in control. But God is. He knows every day of our lives. every event, every choice, every consequence. So, why wouldn't we trust him? He knows the messes that our sin will get us into. That's why he commands us to live the way that he does. Why not just trust him with that? Do we think we can see the future better than he can? Why not just stay away from sin and listen to him? And he sees not only the natural consequences that are going to come from our selfish choices, he sees the eternal consequences, those things that no eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has understood. He tells us what to do for our ultimate and eternal benefit. So when I obey God, is it going to turn out all right? Is obeying God always going to turn out well? Yes, ultimately. Now, in the meantime, we may find that there are some things we had our hearts set on that we're going to have to give up. But that just wasn't a part of his plan for us and for our ultimate well-being. We may have a long way to grow before we even understand how to live the life that he wants us to live. We think that we've got a pretty good idea. Oh, God wants me to do this, and God's okay if I do this. And yet we're so distant from him, so distant from his word, that we don't even know how he wants us to live for our ultimate benefit. That's why we're growing as disciples. We won't immediately get to see all the benefits that he wants to give us either. And the in-between may be difficult. Let's face it, no matter how you live this life, it's going to be difficult. And that's right about the time that we doubt God knows what he's talking about. But if we continue to grow in the knowledge of him, if we continue to obey, God is going to show us why that way was better. So what about when I don't obey? What about when I choose stupid? I do something that I know is wrong, I doubt God's goodness, and I choose sin. Have I just ruined everything? Have I just destroyed everything good that he wanted to give me? That's the really staggering thing about this story. It's the amazing thing about the story of salvation as a whole, that even when we sin, we cannot take God's plan out of his hands. And he continues to work even through our sinful choices to accomplish his redeeming work. The greatest irony in this story is yet another sinful choice that Joseph's brothers make that backfires miserably and beautifully. Joseph has this dream that they're all going to be bowing down to him. They don't believe this is from God. They hate this dream. They don't want to bow down to him. They don't want to submit to him. And so when they see him coming in the distance, they say, "Let's kill him. Then we'll see what becomes of his dreams." And of course, they don't kill him. I think it's safe to say that it was God who appointed that caravan to come by at just that moment so that rather than being killed or left in a pit or even taken home, Joseph was sold into Egypt, where we'll see throughout the rest of this story God fulfill that dream that Joseph dreamed. And God will save his whole family through it. His brothers were so desperately trying to stop this dream from happening, and unwittingly they become God's tool and making it come about. God takes their sin and he uses it to save their lives and the lives of thousands of other people. They cannot derail God's plan. God can even use the rebellion to accomplish it. When we sin against God, when we sin against others, we're disobeying God's rules that were designed to give us the best life that we could possibly have. And yet, such is the grace of God that even when we rebel, even when we shake our fist at God, he can take our hand and lead us into the good that he has for us. Through our sin, God may lead us to that place where we eventually become even sick with ourselves. We're so disgusted with our behavior through that sin that we finally learn how to trust him finally learn how to cast ourselves on His grace and discover how good He is. Through our sin, God may shape us into the person who can bring the gospel to those who have failed in the same ways that we have failed. What shall we say then? Shall we go on sinning so that grace may increase? Not at all. We'll see how miserable the sin of Joseph's brothers makes them for 20 years. This thing is going to haunt them for the next 2 decades of their lives. Our sin will make us miserable, and we shouldn't underestimate the real and lasting damage that it does to us and to others. We can't see the consequences. We can't presume on the grace of God to fix everything that we've messed up. Obedience is always better. And what we see over and over again through our lives, through this story, is that God uses the obedient person in the life of the disobedient to bring that redemption. There was somebody in your life that spoke the gospel to you in obedience to God. And because of that, your life can be redeemed. In the life of Joseph, his brother's sin set him up for what God wanted to do for him, but it was Joseph's faith that led him into the redemption that God was accomplishing. And in the end, the redemption of our sinful lives and the sinful life of every other person on earth is only possible because of the obedience of one man. If Jesus had never lived that perfect life, if he had not obeyed God in going to the cross and dying for us, our sin would only lead to destruction. And yet, lo and behold, in response to our sin, God sends Jesus to take that broken life that we've created and redeem it and make it whole again. We couldn't foresee those consequences. And we are not the ones in control, and thank God for that. If the consequences all depended on my choices, I would poison myself to death with my sin. It would destroy me. But because of a God who is in control, who responded to my sin in a way I never could have predicted, my life has been redeemed and is being redeemed continually for a good and valuable purpose. Trust this God. He is worth trusting. Trust Him enough to obey Him, and trust Him enough to redeem your life, even when you don't. Oh Lord, I don't understand how at this point in our lives we continue to sin. I don't understand why we haven't just learned to trust You and obey You. It makes me sick sometimes to see my continuing failures. And yet, Lord, You are merciful. And You can take this broken life that we've made, this mess we've made, and You can bring us out of it, and You can transform us into something good. Lord, if we have any sin that we're still holding on to, if any person here is still clasping some selfish thing in their life that they say, God doesn't know as well as I do, would You convince them that You have their best interest at heart? That no matter what You ask them to do, no matter what obedience You ask them to walk in, it's going to be better than anything else they could have hoped for. Teach us that lesson, Lord. Teach us to walk with You until we're thoroughly convinced of that. Do that work in our hearts, I pray, in Jesus' name. Amen.